Welcome to the podcast service of Sydney's Heart 1032, available on the web at heart1032.com.au.
Well, sometimes plans change, and sometimes our whole life plans change. Kay Warren had pretty much her life planned out. Once the kids had grown up, she was planning to travel the world, speaking and teaching alongside her husband Rick Warren, the well-known author of the best-selling Purpose-Driven Life. But God had other plans. And when he let Kay know what those plans were, she had the very difficult decision as to whether to say yes or no. Kay Warren is the co-founder of the Saddleback Church in California, and she's just authored this new book, Dangerous Surrender, and she joins us now. Kay, welcome to Open House.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, I understand that this change of plans that I've just alluded to there really took you by surprise. You didn't see it coming at all. But tell me about that spring day in 2002 when you say that God rocked your world.
Well, it began like any other day. I didn't have a clue that was the day that was going to change my life. I was just going about my business and sat down to read one of the weekly news magazine articles that we receive at our home. And I was just leafing through this magazine and saw that there was an article on AIDS in Africa. And I didn't care at all about AIDS in Africa. I didn't care about AIDS anywhere. It wasn't even on my mind. But for some reason that day, I felt compelled to read it. And as I began to read the article, I noticed the pictures that came with it. And they were so awful, I couldn't look at them. Pictures of skeletal men and women and children dying. And they were just awful. So I tried to cover my face with my hands and look at the words without having to look at the pictures. But as I say many times, God is very sneaky. And he knew that if he couldn't get my attention with the pictures, he would use the words. Because right in the middle of that article was a little box that said, 12 million children orphaned in Africa due to AIDS. And that began a whole new life for me, because as I sat there in my very comfortable living room, I realized I didn't know a single person who was HIV positive, and I didn't know a single orphan. And that is what shook me up. How could there be anything so huge in our world and it not touch me in the slightest way?
Yeah. You and Rick were actually approaching the empty nest stage of your life, weren't you? So I alluded before to the fact that you were thinking you were just going to travel the world. How else were you expecting your life to pan out?
I hoped to be a Bible teacher, speaking to women. I love teaching women and college students in particular. I just thought that that was a very logical and very good plan. Made sense to me.
Mm. And yet on that spring day, you felt all of that came crumbling down.
Well, I didn't even know what it meant at first. I just knew I couldn't sleep. I went to bed that night with those words, 12 million children orphaned in Africa, you know, jumping out at me. I woke up the next morning, and again, my first thought were of orphans abandoned and left alone. I couldn't get away from it. It seemed like every time then I would turn on the television, there would be some news story about AIDS or Africa or orphans. And every newspaper I picked at, it was like I was haunted. I couldn't get away from it. And I wrestled with God. I just kept saying, leave me alone. You know, leave me alone. This is too big. This is nothing that has anything to do with my life. What do I know about a medical disease across the world from me? This is just, leave me alone, please. Mm-hmm. And after about a month of internal wrestling and dialogue confusion and a dilemma, I came to a point in which I felt like I hit that old proverbial fork in the road. I had to go one way or the other. I either had to pretend that I had not seen or become a witness to this new reality, or I could do something about it. I could let my heart be engaged. And for me, it felt like I didn't have any alternative but to let my heart be engaged. I couldn't pretend that I hadn't learned what I had learned.
I think for many of us, there really is that struggle when we kind of sense that voice of God to actually do something that we were not planning to do. Maybe we'd never even thought of doing it before. To actually let go of the life that we have. And you mentioned a little bit about that in your book, you know, letting go of your life, your domain, all of the things in your control. You've described the wrestle. What was the final thing where you said, okay, yes, I will be willing to let that go?
Well, for me, as a Christian, as a believer in Jesus Christ, I believe that, you know, at the end of my life, I will give an account of my life, how I lived my life to him. I feel like that's what you know, that's what I understand the Bible to say. Mm. And so I was trying to picture that day. I was trying to picture that day when, where I stand before God and I tell him, you know, what did I do with your son, Jesus Christ? And then what did I do with the life you gave me? What did I do with that information that you gave me that day about the millions of people who were suffering and in need of my help and about the children who were left abandoned? What did I do? I could not envision me having a conversation with God that said, hey, you know what? I was busy. I had a lot of stuff to do. I'm sure you didn't really mean me. I'm sure you had other people who could have done something about it. And I tried to envision that conversation going well, and it didn't. And it just came to the place where I said, you know what? I can't look God in the face someday and tell him I ignored the suffering that I saw.
This is Open House. We're talking to Kay Warren, of course, married to the well-known author and pastor Rick Warren, but she's got a voice of her own and certainly a book of her own, Dangerous Surrender, and a passion of her own too. We must admit, Kay, that you are married to something of a dynamo of a husband, and you mentioned this in your book, you know? I mean, he's always been popular and talented and confident, and he's been the president of every club that he ever joined, and you've got room full of trophies and awards and all those kinds of things. And you say that actually in comparison to him, you actually felt a bit average, didn't you?
Just sort
a bit?
I used to only half jokingly say, you should have married somebody else, you know. You should have married somebody who was prettier and smarter and who was more intelligent than me, more gifted, somebody who knew the Bible better than I do. I just felt so ordinary and so average next to this man who was seemingly at the top of his game at everything. And yet he never felt that way about me. He was always my biggest supporter and cheerleader and pushed me and told me that I could do things that I didn't think I could do. But, you know, it just got really old after a while because he was getting all this attention and I felt so inadequate. And then began to just wonder, maybe I really didn't have anything special to contribute at all. Mm. It was a very lonely time for me. Mm. Very lonely.
I raise that simply because I think a lot of us, when we think of the great problems in the world, in particular the one that that's now gripped your heart, AIDS and HIV, we actually think, well, it's the big people in the world. It's like the Rick Warrens and it's the presidents and it's all of those people who will actually tackle it. What can a little person like me actually do?
Mm. I did feel that way. That was part of my that month-long internal struggle I had was, you know, there was nothing I could do about it. And what I had to come to realize was I didn't have to have a plan. I didn't have to have a strategy. I didn't have to have some sort of a document drawn up that would prove to the world how I was going to conquer AIDS or how I was going to fix all the orphan problems in the world.
Which is very much a Rick Warren response, actually, isn't it? He's the one with all the strategies and the plans.
Yes, he is a strategist and a visionary and a planner, and I realized that I didn't have to do that. What I had to do was bring what I had, and what I had to offer was myself. And that's the one thing that each of us also has. Very few people are, as you say, at the president level or the visionary level or the world leader. Very few are. But everybody has a voice. Everybody has influence. Everybody is a leader, whether they understand it or not. Somebody is listening to what you have to say. And so that's why it's so critical that the things that we talk about and the things that we use our voices for are really things that matter. I think one of the most valuable lessons I've learned in the last 5 years is that when I offer myself, in other words, I bring myself to a situation, I show up, I put my arms around somebody, I look them in the eye, I speak to them, I look into their face as I talk, that is the most powerful gift I can bring. And each one of us has that ability. Mm. It's just that most of us are in too big of a hurry to try and fix something rather than to just be quiet and be still and be with someone who is suffering.
Yeah. Now, the irony of all this, of course, is that your husband, Rick Warren, actually has put together a strategy. It's called the Peace Plan. And from what I understand, it actually has been that he caught your vision. So in some sort of amazing way, you've actually influenced the visionary in the end anyway, but we can talk about that later. What I do want to know, though, is what was the first thing that you did when you finally realized, right, I can just bring what I have, and that's me? What was the first thing that you did then to make a difference to the whole HIV AIDS problem?
Well, I started getting educated because I knew nothing, and what I did know was wrong. I had a lot of myths. I thought HIV was primarily a gay white man's disease, and in my very hard and harsh heart at that moment, I thought that that meant I didn't have to care. If it was a gay man's disease and everybody knows how AIDS is transmitted, then, oh, well, if you're sick, that's your problem. And so my heart was just so hard. So I had to get rid of the myths. More women than men are infected around the world. Mm-hmm. I had to just relearn everything about it, find out the facts. And then I just began to, as part of my learning, I began to travel. I began to go places where AIDS was the strongest, where it was hitting people the hardest. And I made it personal. When AIDS wears a face, it's very difficult to ignore.
Yeah. Kay Warren is our guest on Open House. We will podcast this via the openhouse.net.au. I want to talk about two particular plane trips that you took to Africa. One was to Mozambique in 2003. Then you did a second trip 6 weeks later. Tell me about the first trip and what you were expecting to see.
I didn't know what to expect. I had been to Australia, and I'd been to Hong Kong, and to Canada, and to Mexico. I'd been sort of in my part of the world, but I had never been to a place of extreme poverty or a place of extreme suffering. And so I didn't know what to expect. And so everything was new to me. When we were driving through rural Mozambique, I thought I was at Disneyland because the only place I'd ever seen little mud huts with stick roofs was at Disneyland on the Jungle Cruise. I don't know if your listeners have ever at least even seen pictures of that, but it just felt like I was on the set of a movie. It didn't feel like it was real life. Everyone was walking. Most were walking without shoes. Women were walking carrying babies on their back, plus a 5-gallon jug of water on their head, plus a huge load of firewood, and walking barefoot for miles and miles and miles. And one of the first people I met was a woman named Juana. And when I met her, she was homeless, living under a tree, dying of AIDS. Her village had kicked her and her husband out when they found out that they were HIV positive, and a distant relative had agreed to take care of her, and then that village burned her little stick house to the ground when they found out that she and her husband were positive. So when I met her, she was about a week away from death, living under a tree with unrelenting diarrhea, and just like those pictures I'd seen in that magazine, stick thin, tiny little arms and legs. And when she crawled out to meet me, I was stunned. There was nothing in my faith that had prepared me to talk to a dying homeless woman under a tree. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. I didn't even have the faintest idea. What do you say? I know how to talk to women, you know, who don't know how to lose the last few pounds. And I know how to talk to families when they're struggling with their children. But I didn't know how to talk to a woman who was dying under a tree.
And what did you say?
And, well, the woman who was with me was very experienced, and she had seen this before. And so she showed me how to, just by her own actions, she knelt down next to Juana. She put her arm around her. She prayed for her. She looked her in the face, and she spoke to her about the hope of heaven, that this life was not all that there is. Mm. She had a few anti-nausea pills in her purse that she gave to Juana, even though, you know, that did so little. But I saw something that I'd never seen before, and that was how to offer myself. Because that's what I'm saying. I didn't have a plan. I didn't have a strategy. I couldn't tell her she was going to get well. I couldn't tell her that the villagers were going to accept her. But what I could do was I could give myself. I could put my arms around her, hold her, look her in the face, tell her that she mattered.
Yeah. 6 weeks later, you were on a plane again to Malawi in South Africa. Anything different there?
What I saw in Malawi that I had not seen in Mozambique was to be with children whose parents had died. And so I met what they call in the world of relief organizations, they call them child-headed households. Mm. And it just means orphans. It means children taking care of themselves. And there was a 15-year-old boy, an 11-year-old boy, and a little 3-year-old little sister, the three of them living in a tiny little mud shack with a few little cooking pots and some torn blankets, and that's it. That's all they had. And I sat on that porch outside their little mud hut holding the little baby sister, and I looked very strange to her because, you know, my face is so white and my hair was very blonde and I looked very different. But my heart felt as though it were just in a grip that I was like a vice. I couldn't let go. I wanted to just scream and cry and yell and say, God, where is the mommy? Where is the daddy? Who will take care of these children? Who will raise these children? Who will protect them? There are millions and millions and millions and millions more just like them. Yeah. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah. 33 odd million, I think, that are currently HIV positive and have AIDS. Is that right, around the world?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Kay Warren is our guest on Open House. Theopenhouse.net.au will carry the podcast if you'd like to pass this on to a friend during the week. Well, your church, Saddleback Church, recently held a conference on HIV and the church, and that's got to be a first, hasn't it?
Yes, this was our third year to do it, and I'm not aware of any other church that's doing quite what we've been doing, which is to bring together all the different segments of society, the government, you know, politicians, physicians and scientists, pastors, church leaders, just ordinary church members, relief organizations, everybody we can think of. We've brought together to talk about what can the church do? How can we resource local churches to be a part of the solution for both HIV and for orphans?
Mm. And to the folks that are listening to us now and saying, okay, Kay, you've got me. I need to find out more. I need to do more. What are the steps that you'd run people through just briefly as to what they can do when it comes to HIV/AIDS and being part of the solution?
Well, we think that the solution really is the church. Without local churches, not relief organizations, but local churches, what can local churches do? And so because we believe in the church, we've done an acrostic using the word church. So we believe that every single church, big, small, financially stable, financially weak, every church can care for and support the sick. It's in our mandate to care for people who are sick. Every church can. The H is to handle testing, to encourage people to get tested for HIV. Every church can do that. You don't have to just tell people. They need to know their status. And then the U is to unleash volunteers. The church has millions of volunteers who, if they were mobilized to these issues, could make such a dent in the problems of poverty and illiteracy and sickness. The R is to remove the stigma. You know, it's not a sin to be sick. You will never find Jesus asking somebody how they got sick. You'll find him saying, what can I do for you? How can I help you? And then talking to them in the context of relationship if there were things he needed to say. But so every church can remove the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
The next C is to champion healthy behavior because it's really only the church that has the moral authority to talk about behavior change. Government doesn't have that kind of moral authority, and businesses don't either, but the church does, to talk to people how to change their behavior to protect themselves. And then the last H is to help with medication. And this one is just so simple as calling somebody who's taking the medication for HIV and reminding them to take it, because if they take it right, it will extend their lives.
Mm.
Well, there wasn't anything there in those six things that cost a lot of money. It takes time. And it takes willpower and it takes a commitment. But those are six very simple things that every church could do.
Yeah. Kay, it was made public a few years ago that you were wrestling with breast cancer. I guess to some degree, going through that dark valley must have prepared you a little bit for some of the things you're going to see.
Yes, I was already an advocate for people with HIV when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and
okay.
that was quite a shocking experience to me because I thought perhaps I had misunderstood what God wanted me to do. Here was this whole new vision, if you will, that he had opened up to me for caring for people with HIV and for calling the faith community to be a part of that, and then suddenly I was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness myself.
Mm.
And so it was an unexpected turn in the journey, if you will, but what I learned from that was a new way to relate to people who are sick. I've never been diagnosed HIV positive, but I have had a diagnosis of cancer that if I didn't take medication would kill me. And so it's given me a whole new empathy, a whole new sympathy for people who suffer. I know what it's like. And I'm really grateful. I hope I never have it again, but I'm really grateful that I went through it.
And your current status now, your current health status?
I am in remission, which is what they tell you with breast cancer. They won't ever pronounce you cured, but they will tell you that you are in remission. I've been in remission for almost 4 years.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful news. All right, well, Kay, your book is called Dangerous Surrender, and you have to end up on this question. For some of us who actually are feeling convicted, or it might be with regards to what you've been talking about specifically, HIV and AIDS, or something else that God is nudging us about. He's on our case. He's been speaking to us in some kind of way, and we're just kind of holding out. I mean, how would you encourage people to finally make that risky decision of actually surrendering?
Well, what I've discovered is that God is not safe. As C.S. Lewis said, God is not safe, but he is good. And I think when we try to save our lives for ourselves, when we try to protect ourselves from making these big, risky decisions, we cut ourselves off from a very vibrant and rich life. There is something so amazing about trusting myself to a God that is so big, but is so good. And I have found by doing that, that he has used me. My life is better. I am a better person. I feel like my life has significance and meaning. I know why I'm here. I know why I get up in the morning. I know why he's given me more days and years of my life. It's answered so many of the questions that I had. At the same time, so many questions remain. But that's okay. I trust him more than I ever have before. And I would encourage everyone to find that kind of a relationship with God, to trust themselves to this big God who is dangerous and will shake your world upside down, but who is good at his core.
Mm. Kay Warren, it's been great to have you on Open House. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Good to have you on Open House. Yeah, it's Saddleback Church co-founder and author of Dangerous Surrender, Kay Warren, and kaywarren.com. Here's another website there for you, kaywarren.com.
We hope you enjoyed this Heart 1032 podcast. To listen to more great audio, visit heart1032.com.au.